Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege to present once again Christopher Simpson, the author of, among other titles, The Splendid Blonde Beast, Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century, published in softcover by the Common Courage Press in 1995, and also the landmark Blowback, published in hardcover by Weidenfeld and Nicholson, copyright 1988. Chris, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Hello, Dave.
Even though you published Splendid Blonde Beast in 92 and Blowback in 88, many of the things that you've touched on in those books are once again becoming, are becoming increasingly relevant with some of the recent news stories. Now, in particular, the whole issue of genocide and war crimes is something that is very much in the focus now with Mr. Pinochet. I wonder if you would reflect on the situation of Pinochet and some of his institutional attachments against the background of your work in Splendid Blonde Beast.
What has happened since 1945 is a series of developments in international law that have not yet entirely gelled, but nonetheless are desirable developments. The very fact that Pinochet has been arrested, that it appears that he will be extradited, that it appears he will be put on trial, these are in a certain sense revolutionary advances in international law. What has happened is that through United Nations treaties and through the process of what's called customary international law, there have been a handful of crimes that are so serious, so terrible, and so universally recognized as crimes that any dictator, any general, so forth, is obligated to obey those laws, international laws. And examples of this are that slavery is against the law, against international law, and that a person can be tried for the slave trade or owning slaves anywhere in the world. Genocide falls into the same category. Torture falls into the same category. And a handful of other crimes of comparable seriousness. Organized mass rapes fall into the same category, although one might categorize those as a form of torture. But the point being is that a small number of extremely serious crimes have been recognized as international crimes that people, including Pinochet, can be held accountable for.
One of the factors that has entered into the journalistic discussion and editorial rumination concerning Mr. Pinochet is the fact that obviously his coup in 1973 was supported by the United States and the CIA, and so were some of the subsequent activities of that regime, such as Operation Condor, at least to a certain extent, tacitly, sure, if not overtly. There has been a lot of speculation that the United States would be less than enthusiastic about the trial, about the prospect of Pinochet standing trial.
I think that that's probably true. The United States has got itself into a difficult bind in the matter of international law, and the gist of it is this: that for more than a century, the Americans have been put themselves forward as the world's champions of international law when it suited their purposes politically. For example, during the 1991 Gulf War, but have rejected in principle, on constitutional grounds or claims of constitutional grounds, that they are in any sense subject to international law when they don't like the effects of it. And an example of that is there's a case that grew out of the Iran-Contra affair, in which the World Court at The Hague found against the United States government in the matter of mining Nicaraguan harbors, when the Americans basically thumbed their nose at the whole process. So the U.S. government's approach to international law has been mixed at best. Now along comes the Clinton administration, and one of the principles that the Clinton administration has put forward, really from its first days, is that it wanted to see the creation of an international criminal court to try dictators people who commit extremely serious crimes against humanity. And part of the subtext there, the political agenda there, is to find a means to put on trial people that the U.S. government regards as terrorists. However, at the same time, what has evolved is that literally hundreds of countries around the world have agreed that an international criminal court to try particularly serious crimes such as genocide is a desirable thing, is long overdue, is a welcome development by people of goodwill all over the world. And there, last summer, there was significant progress towards a relatively independent world criminal court for trying such people. The Americans tried in those negotiations, the most polite thing that can be said is that they wanted to have it both ways. They wanted to be able to put on trial the people that they didn't like and protect from trial the people that they did. So along comes Pinochet. I don't see any particular sentiment within the U.S. government for protection of Pinochet as such. There have been statements from the Secretary of State and others to the effect that the U.S. government has no objection to the extradition of Pinochet. I think part of the reason for this is Pinochet is now well into his 80s and will not be on this earth much longer. Nevertheless, a trial of Pinochet inevitably brings into the public spotlight the role of the CIA in Chile and the overthrow of the government in Chile, the role of the CIA and elements that are even less savory than the CIA. I know that some of your listeners may regard that as a contradiction in terms, but nonetheless, what I'm referring to are old line Nazi genocidalists such as Walter Rauf. That those people and U.S. agencies, to the extent that they had a direct role in the crimes of the Pinochet government, and crimes I'm referring here to not just the petty crimes, the systematic looting of the country, which in international law terms is practically a petty crime, but rather the massacres of unarmed civilians, for example, the organized torture camps, these types of genocidal or crimes against humanity, organized rapes of women prisoners. These types of crimes, to the extent that the CIA participated in, ordered, facilitated, failed to stop these activities. If they had authority, if the CIA had the ability to stop the Chilean secret police from torturing prisoners, and they knew that the Chilean secret police were torturing prisoners, the CIA, at that point, becomes complicit in the crime of torture, or at least those parts of the CIA who were in that particular position. And presumably, under international law, as it presently stands, such people could be put on trial. Now, whether or not Washington would yield them up for trial is quite a different question. I would be very surprised if the government in Washington would have that much integrity.
You alluded to Walter Rauff, a figure who was an arch-war criminal in the Third Reich, and in a sense, Walter Rauff actually represents something of an element of continuity between the work that you did in The Splendid Blonde Beast and the Pinochet case. I wonder if you tell us a little bit about him, how he came to escape justice in World War II and arrive in Chile.
Right. Well, Walter Rauff was one of Adolf Eichmann's most important aides. His particular specialty was the were the railroad networks of Europe and how to manage the process of actually rounding up Jews from cities across Europe, getting them loaded into boxcars and getting the boxcars off to either slave labor camps or to extermination camps. He played a similar function in the treatment of Soviet prisoners of war and other people who were persecuted by the Nazis. At the end of the war, there are a series of very curious circumstances that leave unanswered questions about the role of Alan Dulles in particular in the escape of Walter Rauff from Europe, and we can come back to that in a moment. But for the moment, let's continue on with what is clearly on the record. And what's clearly on the record is that Rauff, first of all, finds refuge in a monastery that is run by the Vatican. He gets a false passport that gets him to Syria. And from Syria, he eventually finds his way to Chile, where he sets up shop as a so-called anti-terrorism expert, anti-communist expert, and participates in both as an advisor and a trainer and almost a grand old man of fascism, if there is such a thing. During the Pinochet regime, among Chilean secret police circles. Now, if you'd like to go into the Dulles connection to his escape, it's really quite remarkable. It's there are questions here that have not been answered, and so at least for the moment, it's wise to distinguish what is known from what is not known.
First, let's talk a little bit about Alan Dulles, because he too could be thought of as something of a bridge. He was, of course, as we've spoken about in previous interviews, an attorney with Sullivan and Cromwell, a major Wall Street law firm, then worked for the OSS and later the CIA. Another story that has been in the news recently concerns collaboration between General Motors and Ford and the Third Reich, and that too, along with people like Alan Dulles, is a major focal point of Splendid Blonde Beast. Develop that further for us, if you would.
Sure. What Splendid Blonde Beast is a look at the interaction between money and the law and the development of law. You know, law evolves, just like any other human institution. The interaction between money and law when it comes to laws about crimes against humanity or war crimes. And it begins in World War I with the Turkish government's attempt to exterminate the Armenian population of what is today Eastern Turkey and what is today Armenia. There's now a country, it used to be a Soviet republic and now is an independent country, Armenia. The Turks during World War I carried out a campaign of genocide against Armenians, mainly by deporting them on forced marches into the deserts of what are today northern Iraq and Syria, where the people perished from exposure to element, disease, starvation, and similar suffering. The question at the end of World War One, World War One had been enormously expensive, enormously destructive, obviously to the Armenians whom we were just discussing, but to the entire world as well, And the question was, who's going to pay for it? Now, even the defeated powers agreed that a country or a military unit that had committed a war crime was responsible for making restitution for that war crime. And there was some law about war crimes that existed at that time. There were Hague conventions. And under those conventions, the French went to the peace conference of the day and wanted $200 billion from the Germans to make good the destruction that the German army had wrecked in France. The British had comparable claims, not as high as the French, but still comparable claims, and the Americans also had claims. You had early economists who are now considered practically gods by contemporary economists like John Maynard Keynes, made their early career as advocates of letting the Germans pretty much off the hook because they were afraid that if the Germans actually paid the bill for the destruction that they had left, that there would be a revolution in Germany. And there was much talk of, you know, the Bolsheviks taking over and so forth, but the truth of the matter is what they were what the outside forces were afraid of was a democratic and national nationalist and revolution that would bring to power a democratic labor oriented government, labor in the old-fashioned sense of the term, not in the sense of the British Labour Party. Anyway, the upshot of all this was that Allen Dulles's brother, John Foster Dulles, who eventually became U.S. Secretary of State, worked a deal with the other powers in Europe in which war crimes and crimes against humanity were defined so narrowly, so tightly, so parsimoniously that the German financial obligation was quite low, and more importantly, when looked at from historical perspective, what that meant was that when Hitler began systematic persecution of Jews, when the Kristallnacht burnings of temples began, when the systematic theft of Jewish property began in Germany, and so on, that the outside world said that these aren't war crimes, right? They may be unpleasant, we don't like them, etc., etc., but there's nothing that we can do about it. This was the American position of the time. It was the British position of the time.
The use of slave labor, which is front and center in the ongoing lawsuit against Ford and GM, was just such a crime.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And part of this, see, this again returns to the question of the Turkish persecution of Armenians. Armenians were part of Turkey. They were Turkish citizens. And therefore, under war crimes law, as it stood at that time, it was impossible for Turks to commit war crimes against the citizens of their own country. It was the way the law was set up. You could only commit a war crime against a country that you were at war with. So that if you committed genocide against your own people, it wasn't criminal. Now, or it had the appearance of not being criminal. Now, the overwhelming majority of powers, in fact, every single power at the peace treaty that ended World War I, with the exception of the United States, favored as one of the first terms of the peace treaty that ended World War One, a recognition of a crime against humanity. The genocide of the type that the Turks had perpetrated against the Armenians was a crime against humanity. That this was different from a war crime. This was in part a crime that an organized state committed against its own people. So that when Germany began to commit, and the Americans blocked this, the American representative to this World War One peace conference happened to be John Foster Dulles's uncle, Robert Lansing. I mean, that's in part how Dulles, who was then a very young man, ended up with such influence at this particular negotiation. And Lansing refused to transmit. This starts to become rather bureaucratic, but through a variety of bureaucratic mechanisms, Lansing sabotaged the will of every other country in the world of the time on this issue of crimes against humanity. So the Armenians got the shaft. The Armenians subsequently were betrayed in other ways, mainly in exchange for American oil rights in what used to be the Ottoman Empire in Saudi Arabia and Iraq and Iran, what are today Saudi Arabia and the little desert sheikdoms and so forth, and Iraq, by the way. The Americans got the oil, the Armenians got the shaft. When Hitler came to power, he was, for the most part, and the Nazis, for the most part, especially in the first years, were committing crimes against people who were, in fact, Germans. They were Jewish, but they were Germans. They were German citizens. Many of them were veterans of World War One who had fought in the German army in World War One. But with the racial ideology of the Nazis, their property was taken from them, and they were beaten on the streets. The SS would arrest them arbitrarily, and I think all of your listeners are reasonably aware of the types of crimes that were committed against Jews in Germany. So from the standpoint of the outside world, from the standpoint of the British, from the Americans and so forth, also from the French, these were not crimes. Hitler had legalized them. They weren't war crimes. It's because Germany was not at war with itself. And there was no such thing as a crime against humanity. It's because the Americans had blocked it at the end of World War One. So as distasteful as Hitler might have been, there was nothing illegal in an international sense about what he was doing. And that, in turn, had two effects. One of them was that despite much tutting and sort of self-righteous rhetoric coming from Western countries about what a monster Hitler was, there were great business opportunities to be made in Germany. And one of the most lucrative business opportunities was stealing property from Jews, where German banks and lawyers and so forth could force, either through terror or a variety of legal means, a Jewish family to sell its real estate or its company or its little street corner business, whatever, its home, the family's home, whatever, for a fraction of its price. And this was all done with all of the, you know, the papers and the notary stamps and all the, you know, the formalities of conventional commerce. And this reached such a point, and this became so institutionalized, that there were actually bonds traded on American stock exchanges or bond exchanges that were de facto Aryanization bonds, where American investors would purchase this bond, and then the bond company would go and use their money to participate in the theft of Jewish property and then pay profits back to the Americans who had invested in this particularly disgusting means of making profits. That process, that teamwork, if you will, and the relatively small number of Americans and Germans at the very top of the social structure in both of those countries, international trade in those days was hard to do. Communications were poor. Getting across the Atlantic Ocean was a, you know, it took a month or more to get a ship across the Atlantic Ocean. A transcontinental telephone call was a major event that got written up in newspapers, for heaven's sakes. So doing business internationally was not at all easy in those years, and so the companies involved in it tended to be the largest and most powerful companies, tended to be from a small number of industrial sectors, oil, certain agribusiness, particularly bananas. The United Fruit Company was very active in this. And machine tools, the Singer Sewing Machine Company, which makes quite a number of devices, including weapons, beyond in addition to its sewing machines, or it did during that period anyway. IBM National Cash Register of those years and so forth were involved in this transatlantic trade. Also were General Motors and Ford Motor Company, which have been on the front page of major newspapers in recent weeks for their collaboration with the Nazis. Now, anybody who's followed this issue anybody who's done intelligent reading about World War II has known for decades that the Ford Motor Company and General Motors were up to their eyeballs in a variety of joint projects with the Nazis, both prior to the American entry into the war and in somewhat different form after the American entry into the war. This is not like a big surprise to people who have looked at this seriously. There were hearings even during World War II by a popular West Virginia senator who.
Chris, let's excuse me for interrupting. We're going to take this up on the other side of our discussion. For Chris Simpson, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.